Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to enter the carpet remnant world of Stuart Lee. That was a bit heavy metal, rock and roll, that. Can we have some funny music at the start of the second half? Yep. Thanks for coming. OK, what news do you know about? Leveson Inquiry, that's ongoing. News of the World went down. I was sorry to see the News of the World go down. I think it was a great campaigning newspaper. Not everything I say is sarcastic, Sheffield. No, who can forget the News of the World's high-profile campaign against child sex offenders, which led, didn't it, to News of the World readers burning down the home of a paediatrician. Throwing rocks at a pedalo. And stamping on a centipede. Top of the show, paedophile jokes going down well. Good to have been on television and finally managed to attract so much of Jimmy Carr's audience. The show's not aimed at you, don't come again. I'm trying to find out what news you know about so I can weave the stories into a seamless two-hour narrative-driven whole. A seamless narrative-driven whole. You have to do that, I think. If you're a name act going out doing the long theatre shows, you can't just go out and do 90 minutes of unrelated little gags that you can subsequently chop up into smaller parcels and resell to Mock the Week and Live at the Apollo. Well, yeah, you can do that, can't you? So what news do you know about? I think the funniest news story at the moment is the trial of the Norwegian neo-Nazi mass murderer, Anders Behring Breivik. And you're going, hang on, there's nothing funny about that, Stu. But there is. And it's this, that on his website, Anders Behring Breivik, the Norwegian neo-Nazi mass murderer, has written this genuine sentence. Jeremy Clarkson's Top Gear is one of the few programmes worth watching on the BBC. Now, very rarely do you see a better example of what philosophers call the banality of evil. And remember, all that's required for Jeremy Clarkson to triumph is that Richard Hammond do nothing. Remember when Jeremy Clarkson made those jokes about shooting strikers and everyone complained? There was a guy from the Daily Telegraph went on the Channel 4 News to defend him and he said, come on, he said, it was just a joke, he said. It's not as if a Jeremy Clarkson fan has ever gone out and shot anyone. I thought, well, there was that one guy. The mass murderer. Poor old Colonel Gaddafi had a bad year last year, didn't he? The Libyans got fed up with their leader, pulled him out of a sewer, shot him in the face, mutilated the anus of his corpse with a knife and chucked him in a meat refrigeration unit. But they did that off their own backs, didn't they, the Libyans? No one made them do it. They did it entirely voluntarily of their own initiative. What better example is there of the big society in action? Will the big society work? Whether we think so depends on our immediate experience of society around us. Now, of course, David Cameron thinks the big society will work because he lives in a nice little village in Oxfordshire, Witney, and all the four times a year, all the local people in Witney, that's David Cameron, Jeremy Clarkson, Rebecca Brooks, and the cheese bloke from Blur. They all get together voluntarily. They go out and they clear out the waste ground in the village, big society in action. Now, I know the big society will work, because where I live, in Hackney, in East London, last August, all the local Turkish shopkeepers went out onto Dalston High Road and attacked the rioters with kebab knives. Now, this show is called Carpet Remnant World. Now, since I've been on the telly, I'm picking up a lot of stragglers, people that don't normally come and see me. There's twice as many people as I've played to in Sheffield before here tonight, and the kind of people that come and see people just off the telly, the kind of shows you go and see by comics, they're normally called things like Laugh Time, aren't they, or Jokerama 6, something like that. Now, if you've seen me before, and I hope you have, I don't like new people coming. You'll know what my shows, they tend to be a relationship between the title and the content. That's the bare minimum of what you should offer, I think. Not so much this year, though. It's not really come together very well, this show. It was supposed to be about idealised notions of society and how we behave as collective groups. But I've been a bit busy with one thing or another. It's not really worked. So, but what I will do is about 5 minutes from the end, it's about 10 o'clock, I will repeat the phrase carpet remnant world over some music, and that will give the illusion of structure. And big laughs down here for that. People down here, the people who bought the tickets first, they've seen me before and they're going, oh, of course there'll be content and structure. We've seen him before. This is a comedic double bluff, ha ha, right? But up there, there's a lot of people, they don't really know what they've come to. They've come, friends have bought them, they're the worst. A couple of people that like me, they've gone, well, let's get Gene and Chris to come as well. And they've come and they don't know who I am, and they've been whispering all through it up there, in the top bit there. Thinking, is this it? Is this who you wanted to see? Seems like an aggressive lecture. It's very strong, and it will gradually, that whispering doubt, that will spread all round the top balcony up there, and that will be no one laughing up there by the end because of people bringing their friends. And I was quite happy with one night in Sheffield, to be honest, because, and you've brought friends along and you can feel it's not as good as it was last time, which is a shame because we're filming it tonight, so thanks. I won some awards, that doesn't help, British Comedy Awards. Because people go, oh, he's won an award, we'll enjoy that. And you won't. Winning a British Comedy Award is like having a big sign put over your head saying, hey, dicks, come to this. What can you do there? You can't stop people coming, you know. It'd be all right. It's strong down here. I won't even look up there. So we'll press on into the void. No, I thought I'd record this here because last time I was in this theatre, it was fantastic. But the audience is, we've got two nights now, more people come, but you can see it's a worse kind of person. Shame. It's gone to all this trouble with all these cameras now. Oh, I came to Sheffield, it was brilliant last time. You know, it was, but it's all right, isn't it? It's not going well down here, isn't it? But up there. There's people down here thinking, oh, it's the kind of thing he does, he mucks about like this, it'll be all right. And up there, there's people going, oh, he doesn't, I've not seen him before, he doesn't seem to be able to do stand up. I can do it really well, actually. No, I'm really good at it. I'm so good at it that one of the things that I do, I make it look like I can't do it. But I can. And if you're sitting there, having been brought by friends, thinking, oh, you can't do it, the question you have to... I've been on stage thousands of times, literally. The question you have to ask yourselves up there, people's friends, is how many times have you been to stand-up and what kind of acts have you seen? It's maybe four or five times. You haven't seen the right sorts of people. You've got no context for me. So... you're not in any position to have an opinion about it. Good, that's warmed the room up. It'll be all right, don't worry about it. Okay. So, on May the 2nd last year, I was driving along the M4. That's what I mainly do now. I mainly drive around on motorways or look after my kids. That's why I've not had really enough time to make this show good. So, I was driving along the M4. It was the day Bin Laden was shot by the Americans. And there were all different Americans coming on the radio talking about what they thought about it. And it made me think, what we like, collective groups of people, human society. Here's four real quotes by real Americans on May the 2nd, the day Bin Laden was shot. This first guy, he's called Thomas Cox. He's a construction worker talking in Times Square on Radio 4. And he said... I made Photoshop pictures of the Statue of Liberty holding Osama's bloody severed head and handed them out to the crowd. It's payback. It's not, is it? But payback for Osama, surely, was being shot in the face at point blank range. Thomas Cox's offensive collage. It merely adds insult to injury. Bin Laden was buried at sea, you'll remember. As Thomas Cox goes on, he says, "We should have mounted his head on a spike. I am hoping that the fish and the crabs are having a good..." That's never got a laugh before. I'm glad we came to Sheffield. After all, people found the combination of fish and crab amusing here in a way that no other British city has. It was worth it. But only down here, the people up there. With their fish and crab, who cares? He said, "There isn't time to improvise tonight, unfortunately. We're filming it, so I'll just move on. Otherwise, I could have got 10 minutes out of that fish and crab bit, you know." "Hello, Michael." "Yes." Are you bringing the roadshow here to Sheffield?" "Yeah, fish and crab stuff. They love it." I basically go everywhere first and I sound it out for him. He ignores what I say. "We should have mounted his head on a spike," he said. "I am hoping that the fish and the crabs are having..." second time. "Yeah, only once though, only once. Don't milk it. Paul Tonkinson will sort it out for you. All right. We should have mounted his head on a spike. I'm hoping that the fish and the crabs are having a good meal on his eyeballs." Now, it's a very apposite quote, that, because as you all know, under Sharia law, if a Muslim man is buried at sea, it is required that their body be protected from the attentions of fish. And I think it was that this Thomas Cox was alluding to there. If you've not seen me before, I don't think that. I think the opposite of that. Okay? That's one of the things I do. I make a very bold statement about something, but the implication is actually the opposite of... I'm going to do that about 6 times tonight. And then later on, about 9:45, I'll go on about something for too long. That'll be later, all right. Now, this next quote from an American called Stephen Reginella, again on Radio 4 in Times Square, and he said, "They should have brought Bin Laden's body here and hung it from the lamppost. In fact, they should have roasted him here, like a chicken. So he would have seen what it felt like." It's all over the place, that, isn't it? "They should have brought Bin Laden's body here alive, presumably, and hung it from the lamppost." What lamppost is that? The New York City designated corpse roasting lamppost. Who should have done that? They should. Who are they? The New York City designated corpse roasting team. They don't do a lot of corpse roasting. Their duties mainly entail maintenance of the corpse roasting lamppost. "Roast him like a chicken. So he would have seen what it felt like." There you are, Bin Laden, on the lamppost, roasting, yeah. Can you see what that feels like? I can feel what it feels like. That wasn't a question. What if we hold this mirror up, full length mirror? Can you see what it feels like now? I can see what it looks like. This is exactly the kind of unhelpful behaviour you'd expect. "Roasted like a chicken." Why? Like, we've all roasted a chicken at some point in our lives, haven't we? No need for this kind of frontier justice, is there? He didn't have any issues with chickens, did he, Bin Laden? It was the West that he hated, wasn't it? And our values, not chicken. Imagine if he had hated chickens, Bin Laden, and he'd applied the same level of firepower over a 10-year period to the eradication of poultry that he had to Western democratic systems. I'm not an expert, but I think we'd be looking at a very different global geopolitical setup. Again, the laughs are down here for that, aren't they? Down here, up there, people down here. People up there going, what are they laughing at down there? I'll tell you. I said, if he'd hated chickens, we'd be looking at a very different global geopolitical setup. And the people down here, I think, they just thought for a second about what that would be like. They imagined it in their own heads. I don't know what they imagined. Chickens on fire, I don't know. But the important thing, people's friends who've come by mistake, is they put in an extra bit of effort and they got more laughs out of that in their own heads. But you just sat up there, didn't you, going, oh, he's finished saying that. Then you had a little think, didn't you, about something else. Got all the £90,000 for an apartment in the park. And then you went, oh, I wonder what he'll say now. But if you're sitting there, I'm not one of these, I don't act things out, you know, and do, I just do the gag and I just leave it. And I walk away from it, I let people make of it what they will, you know. There's not, you know what I mean? To raise your game. This next quote from an American was on the YouTube, you've seen that, where the people film themselves talking. This was an American lady talking to camera. She said, I so happy Osama be dead. I climb stoplight and show my two titties at the crowd. Everyone be cheering, everyone be whistling. I so happy Osama be dead. My titties be pretty big titties too. Osama, one holy motherfucker. But he a man, and got a kick out of these hot titties. Word. This last one, this was on the YouTube as well. A chap running around in one of the big towns there, waving a flag, and he said, they should get Max Hardcore out of jail. I didn't know who Max Hardcore was when I heard this quote. He's a bloke that he's in violent American pornography. And I didn't know who he was, so I looked him up on the internet. And now I'm on the sex offenders register. Max Hardcore. I thought he was just a very efficient builder. This is what this. They should get Max Hardcore out of jail to reverse cowgirl Osama's body on the White House lawn. Max would tear that Muslim faggot's dead body a new hole. Know what I'm saying? They should get Max to reverse cowgirl him on the White House lawn and FedEx the tapes to his family saying, look at this, you gay cunts. Fuck with America, you are fucking with God. Prepare to have your assholes ripped open. I know, it's amazing quote. Now, I don't think it's fair to make hard and fast generalisations about a whole society based on just four random quotes. But if I was going to do that, I'd say, what do we learn about America from these four quotes? It's obsessed with its own blind patriotism, with its own religious fundamentalism, with sexualized violence, and there's a weird homophobic undercurrent going through some of those quotes as well. Interesting thing about those four quotes. The second interesting thing about those four quotes, I think, is that of those four quotes, only two of them were made up by me. Such is the depth of your blind anti-American prejudice. You've got no idea which ones they are. You go, no, they could all be true, Stuart. If they're not, they should be, because that's what they're like. Making stuff up, making up quotes. Not good enough, is it? But, you know, what can I do? I've got nothing. I drive around and look after kids. I've got nothing. Anyway, that's enough making fun of America and the West. It's time now to mock Islam and to ridicule individual Muslims. People are very keen on that now. In comedy, there was a big piece in the Daily Mail in December by Jan Moyer saying there's not enough anti-Islamic stand-up in Britain at the moment. Of course, they're very keen on balance at the Daily Mail. It's been a watchword of the paper going way back to the 1930s. I know, it's a good joke, but no one gets it. So, but it's an occupational hazard of stand-up now. If you do a joke about anything, you don't immediately follow it up with a joke about Islam. People go, oh, what's wrong with you? These are the kind of emails you get, this sort of thing. Dear BBC, I enjoyed Stuart Lee's making fun of Chris Moyles on TV last night, and I look forward to him mocking the Prophet Muhammad in the same way next week. Yours, Norris McWhirter. Nuremberg. Another one here. Dear BBC, I enjoyed watching Stuart Lee making jokes about crisps last night. But I doubt we will be seeing him having a go at any Muslim snacks in the near future. On the politically correct BBC, it appears there's one law for crisps. And quite another for those mini poppadom things that they sell in Marks and Spencer's. Yours, Norris McWhirter. Argentina, yeah. Well, it's a later postmark. So, I don't get it. It's time to ridicule the Muslim now, in accordance with the Daily Mail's demands. And the Muslim we're going to be ridiculing tonight is called Muhammad Al-Kabaizi. He's from Dubai, and he's one of the top Muslim guys out there. And, yeah, people down there laughing at that. As well they should. Because, of course, in Islam, there is no pyramid power structure. It's a succession of imams all with equal power. So the idea of a top Muslim is... Anyway, this is what he said, Muhammad Al-Kabaizi, about bin Laden being buried at sea. He said, they can say they buried him at sea, but they cannot say they did it according to Islam. Sea burials are permissible for Muslims in extraordinary circumstances only, and this is not one of them. Let's have a quick recap on those circumstances. Osama bin Laden was shot in the face at point-blank range in front of his family after a possibly illegal American incursion into Pakistani airspace following a 10-year campaign to bring him to justice for flying two hijacked, fully laden passenger aircraft into the World Trade Center, killing literally thousands and thousands of people. What has made this Muhammad Al-Kabaizi so jaded? But this does not fit his definition of extraordinary circumstances. What a jaded, jaded man, Sheffield. Not the sort of man you'd want to have to organise a surprise birthday party for. So that's a Muslim ridiculed. Time now for some anti-Islamic stand-up. Jan Moyer in the Daily Mail says there's not enough stand-up about Islam. There's loads, actually, if you think about it. There's Roy Chubby Brown, your spiritual king in this region. He goes round and round doing loads, and Tim Minchin's done stuff about Islam to stadiums full of people. And, of course, there's dozens of British comics of an Islamic background talking about it all the time, night after night. So I think there's so much stand-up about Islam. I don't really know what to bring to the table. So what I've been trying to do on this tour is something that's not been done before. I've been trying to do observational comedy, yeah? That's kind of BBC One, ITV One sort of, oh, look at that kind of stuff. I've been trying to do observational comedy of a specifically anti-Islamic bent, yeah? Anti-Islamic observational comedy. I've had some good reviews for that. You know, people went, oh, brilliant. Like Islamophobic Michael McIntyre. That was good. Superb, the John Bishop of cultural relativism. So, here we are now, Sheffield, with some anti-Islamic observational comedy. Anti-Islamic observational comedy. Observational comedy. Have you seen these Muslims they have now? It's the end of that bit. People up there going, oh, now it's picking up. I've got three anti-Islamic one-liners now that I'm hoping to sell on to Roy Chubby Brown. Here they are. Hey, you know where one in two kids born in Britain today is called Mohammed, and that's just the girls. I've not got the exact figures. Do you know one in two Islamic hate preachers in Britain today has got hook for his hands and a bad eye? I've done no research. You know, one in two people claiming to be a spokesperson for the entire British Muslim community is, in fact, the unelected leader of a non-democratic special interest fringe group given ideas above its station by a misguided New Labour community bridge-building initiative. Some laughs, a lot of people going, what was that? What was that supposed to be? Tell you what that was, my coming era friends. That was the best joke about Islam in Britain anyone's ever done. That's what that was. It was even-handed, it was informed. It's what you say you want, isn't it? You go, do stuff about Islam. I just did. Not like that, Stu. Not where you have to know anything. When we said do stuff about Islam, we meant make fun of their hats. What can I do? I've got nothing. I drive around, I look after kids. I've got nothing. But fair enough for not laughing at that. You know, it's an edgy subject. It makes people uncomfortable. You know, you're thinking, oh, where's this going? If you've got stuff that makes people uncomfortable, what they say on the comedy courses now, they say, take the curse off it, take the edge off it, personalise it, yeah? Make it personal to you. So I was walking around with my son, who's real. I was walking around where I live with my son, and there was a Muslim lady coming along the road towards us. It's a very cosmopolitan area where I live in London. It's a very, very cosmopolitan area. No, it is. My dentist, it's a very cosmopolitan area. My dentist is actually a lesbian. At least I assume she's a lesbian. because she had me out under general anaesthetic, and when I came round, I hadn't been sexually assaulted. There was some rectal bleeding. You expect that at my age, obviously. Different pockets of laughs, weren't there, throughout that joke? But never a point where the whole theatre laughed as one. Why not? Not a very good joke, that's why. Let's go back over it and see what was wrong with it. Yeah? Now, it wasn't clear, was it, what the point of it is? That joke. What was I saying? Was I saying, hey, guess what? I'm so attractive, my dentist must be a lesbian, otherwise she would have sexually assaulted me when I was unconscious. Was that the joke? Some people thought so. Or was the joke that I was implying that all dentists are indiscriminate sexual predators? It wasn't clear, not everyone laughed. So what I did, I don't know if you noticed, I put an extra bit on the end, didn't I, about rectal bleeding. And for a lot of you, that just tipped the joke over, didn't it, to being funny enough to laugh at. And that's an old stand-up trick. We all do that. If you watch a lot of stand-up, you'll see we all do it. Got a joke, not funny enough. Put an extra bit on the end about anal rape or rectal bleeding. And that will just nudge it into being funny. Old stand-up trick, extra bit on the end, anal rape, rectal bleeding. We have a name for that technique in the trade. We call that Boyle's Law. Anyway, I was walking along where I live with my son. 4 years old. There's a Muslim lady coming towards us, full burqa, just her eyes shine. And my son, he's four. He meant nothing by this. He looked at her and then he said to me, is that a ghost? Right? I thought, what are you going to say? What am I going to say? So I said to him, I said, no, it isn't a ghost. It's a lady and she's religious and she believes in God and she believes that God wants her to cover her face. I thought, that's all right, say that. And then my son said, why? And it was at that point I realised I'd reached the limit of my knowledge of Islam. I don't really know any more about it than that and the killings and stuff. And neither do you, do you? You don't know anything about it either. Even those of you of an Islamic background are normally quite hazy about the details when pressed. And that's why it's so difficult to do jokes with any real depth on the subject, because there isn't really enough of a shared collective pool of knowledge between performer and audience to be able to move off the most obvious areas, really. So stop sending me your stupid fucking email. Why? That's always a terrible moment in parenting, isn't it, if you've got kids? Why? Now, normally, I just say, because I say so. And I leave it at that. Well, that wouldn't work in this situation, if you think about it. God wants her to cover her face. Why, Dad? Because I say so. That is handing a child a lifetime of psychological illness, isn't it? 40 years later, he's in therapy. Then did you first decide that your father had power over the gods? Always Spanish, aren't they, those blokes? Yeah, you like that? A switcheroo? He sounded German, turned out he was Spanish. Not impossible, is it? Could have been born in Spain, trained in Germany, come over here to work. Maybe it's not such a funny situation after all. You have to watch out. Some of the jokes are traps. They're not meant to be laughed at. You walked into it. Why? You know, I mean, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have faffed around trying to say the right thing. I just said to him, it's because she's religious, and that's the same as being mentally ill. But the problem is now, right, my wife, his mother, who I love, she's proper religious, going to church, Catholic. So these days, I have to maintain a gossamer-thin, false veil of painfully begrudged tolerance for people's mad beliefs. If I wanted to make me a fucking sandwich... Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Just for Laughs, the 95th Montreal International Comedy Festival, bringing you the best of North American stand-up. So I said to my wife, shut up, bitch! Fuck my dick! Lick my ass! And make me a fucking sandwich! That's all it is for 2 weeks. First week in English, second week in French. Weirdly, in French, that sentence sounds rather delightful. Listen. Tais-toi, salope. Caresse mon cul avec ta langue. Caresse ma bite avec tes lèvres. Et quand t'es fini, sois gentil et fais-moi une putain de délicieuse baguette. Et en puis, je saigne de mon anus. No. Right. Okay, usually when we're not filming the show, that joke goes so well that I end the first half on that. Saying the end of my anus, people, yeah, brilliant. Callback in French, applause. People go, yeah, and I go, yeah, that's the end of that. Can't end it like that, can you, Orf? You can't end it with 500 Sheffield people just looking at you. Can I have about five minutes, yeah? You've got enough tape. Right, okay. Well, I'm going to explain what the joke is. I'm going to do it again. Okay. Because I want to then... I want to... You know, I said I wasn't going to do anything differently just because we were filming it. I am going to do this differently because it'd be really awkward, you know. It's been a high point. Outside of Chef, I don't know. Okay. Je saigne de mon anus, right? That is a callback to the idea that you put a bit about rectal bleeding on the end of a joke to... And that's... Je saigne de mon anus. That's... I'm bleeding from my anus in French, right? And it was about 3 minutes ago, the setup for that. I'll tell you what's funny about that is... I got this comic, Hills Barker, to translate that. And she said, it's Yesenia de mon anu. And I said to her, I'm going to say anus, because then people will have no excuse for not making the... We don't do languages here, son. Even if it's obvious what the words mean. It's a point of principle. Okay, it doesn't matter, but... Forget that. I'll dub a big... You'll see this when it's made. There'll be a huge laugh dubbed on. It won't matter. But I'll cut away to a football stadium of people. I'll get some footage from Michael McIntyre's video. I'll cut it in. Okay, the worry is, though, that there's a whole second half to come, right? And and that was a 3 minutes, that call back. And the problem is, the second half is all things that relate back to the first half. And I don't know if up there you've been... I don't know what's gone in. I think the problem is that people today, especially young people, actually, you're used to watching little tiny things on your phones and stuff, aren't you, and short things. This isn't a succession of moments. This show is a continuum, right? It's like a narrative. So it's not like, when I've said something, you can't go, oh, he said that, I'll erase that from my mind. It might come back. It's like if you meet someone in life, you know, I've met them, I'll forget them now. You might... and I don't know what's gone in, and it doesn't matter, but I really wanted to film this here because it was so good here before, and I don't know what's happened tonight. It's okay, but it's not, and so I'm just going to go back over the first half, and not every line of it, but I'm just going to flag up things that you should have noticed. And then when we get to edit this, you know, if it's still not, the second half's not really good, I won't be looking and thinking, oh, I could have, you know, I'll have done whatever I could have done, yeah? Are you right for time? Okay, so I came out, didn't I, at the beginning? I did. Remember when there was no one here? And then I was here. That's when I came out. I know, you didn't, because you were talking, weren't you, to your friend, going, oh, what have you been down? I went down the moor today. With me, I think about everything. And there was loud rock music, one of the Armand Duhl 2, that was from Germany. And I went, don't play that, that's too loud, you know. Play something funny in the second half. I always get them to play that music. It's setting up a joke for the start of the second half. You'll see when I come back on. So I came out and I did sort of topical stuff, didn't I? About 5 minutes of topical stuff. And I expect some of you are going, no, we don't need to listen to this, it's sort of warm-up stuff. You're very wrong, because it was... It looked very casual, didn't it? Oh, what about this bit of news? But it all was about ideas of idealised societies, wasn't it, if you think about it? Yeah, and that's what I wanted you to log from that. That went in. Then I did about 10 minutes, I read out things other people said in a sarcastic voice, and it was funny, wasn't it? Remember that? Yes, it was. You all laughed. You can't go, oh, that's all it was, and withdraw your laughter. You can't. Then I did about 15 minutes on something funny my son said, didn't I? Now, it was about Islam. It was quite interesting. But at the end of the day, what kind of a routine was that? Oh, dear. It was a don't kids say the funniest things routine, wasn't it? And if you're a 44-year-old stand-up and you're in Sheffield on a Friday night... talking about something funny your kid said, you should kill yourself, I think. But what can I do? I've got nothing. I've got no stuff. I drive around, I look after kids, I've got nothing. I have no experiences, I don't know about anything to talk about. I drive round and round. 150 nights I was on the road last year, you know. I'm not complaining. I'm very lucky to be able to do this, and I enjoy performing. You know, not tonight, obviously. It's not enjoyable. It's interesting. It's not enjoyable. It's like being trapped in a thicket. Trying to get out, you know. It's an interesting problem. It's not fun, is it? 150 nights, and you know, I used to like that in the 80s going round, but now everywhere's the same, you know. Sheffield's quite interesting, keeps changing. be nice when you've decided what it's supposed to be, I think. That place, the park, I remember when that was awful. That's brilliant now, isn't it? You know, you never know what... It's, but most places are just... They're all the same now. They just... There's an old bit that was like a Victorian slum. That's now the bit everyone wants to live in. Then there's a 70s bit that was the bit everyone liked in the 70s. That's now the bit everyone hates. And in that bit, there's a Poundland, a super drug, and a branch of the Works. In every town. And the Works, to be honest, that's the only thing to me that's interesting about travelling around Britain now. Going in the Works. Because you never have any idea what's going to be in the Works. Sort of stocked at random. It's nominally a bookshop, but it appears to be run by people who have a deep-seated suspicion of books. And they'll do anything they can to stock anything other than a book. You go in the Works, is this a bookshop? Yes. Have you got this new Ragnarok by A.S. Byer? It's won loads of awards. No. Have you got this new book, Savage Continent, about the aftermath of World War II? It's been, no. Have you got any novels? Dan Rhodes, he's got a new novel out, a novelist, everyone thinks he's good. No. Have you got a triple pack of 1930s Belgian horror films? A 1998 Richard Bacon calendar. And a papier-mâché make-your-own concentration camp craft kit. Oh, we've got them, yeah. And they're on a three for the price of two offer. Apart from the Works, going around the country is just... Go back to the same places year after year. It makes you feel... 25 years, it makes you think about your own mortality, your own life. But I'll give you an example of what I mean. My dad, for example, right? My dad is dead now. But my dad was a rep for a cardboard company. And he spent 50 years driving around the motorways showing people samples of cardboard. Not real cardboard, obviously. Samples of what cardboard could be like. I think about him, I think about me. I've spent 25 years driving around the motorways showing people samples of jokes. You see how impossible it is to work this room? Because I... No, I've... You can't, because... Down here, I don't even need to finish that joke off. They've thought, oh, yeah, samples of jokes, that'll be the same as samples of cardboard. Samples of what jokes could be like. But up there, you're just going, oh, why is he talking about cardboard? What's that? It's actually not doable. It's very... Because down here, this is like a vision of... this is what it could be like, you know? Where you're not like some dick, like, doing jokes. You're just putting an idea out there, and they play around with it, and it comes back to you. It's like a dialogue. It's like a vision of a utopian... And then up there... It's never going to be that, because of... It's extremely particularly tonight, it's frustrating that this would happen. When it's being filmed, because you can feel this could be the best, it is within sight of being the best stand-up has ever been filmed. But it won't be, because about a third of the room... That's why I came back here, I love this theatre. This was two or three years ago, this was the biggest room I'd ever played. I thought, I'll go to Sheffield, I'll do it there. And it's not, what's so frustrating? 25 years, and I've been, every year, build up, getting them people, and I don't know what's gone wrong. I don't know what's gone wrong. You can feel down here, it's like a different thing, you can feel down here. wish I was dead. Not dead. I wish I was a dead comedian. Because you love dead comedians, don't you, all of you? You love the dead comedians, don't you? Oh, Frank Carson. Oh, dead. Brilliant Frank Carson when he, oh, he's dead. Oh, Ken Goodwin. Oh, dead Ken Goodwin. Oh, he's brilliant. The middle class people. Oh, dead Bill Hicks. Oh, Bill Hicks. Dead Bill Hicks. Oh, he's brilliant. I wish I was dead Bill Hicks. I wish I could be judged on 2 hours of material. Lazy, dead, fat Bill Hicks. Be easy to be dead, Bill. It's easy being dead. The hard thing, if you're a comedian, is to stay alive. Keep on knocking out a new 2 hours every year, gradually decreasing the quality of your own obituary. This is an incredibly frustrating situation for the to be filming tonight and to have this. Makes me feel impotent, you know, powerless, no control. Of course, my wife wants me to have a vasectomy. Or even she admits there isn't really any pressing need. Do you feel, when you've been married a long time, anyone, you feel that your partner stops viewing you as a sexual being? Do you find that? Sheffield. I do. That's an example of what I mean. I've been married 7 years. 6 years ago, we've been married a year. I went off to work in Germany for 2 months. And while I was there, I ran out of pants, yeah? Now, like a lot of men, I don't really know where my pants come from. I always seem to have some, but I don't remember ever buying any. So I bought some pants in Hanover, German pants, blue pants with yellow stars on them. I got back to London, 1 year of marriage, and my wife said to me, "You've bought new pants, are you having an affair?" Right? Which is funny, but it's also, it's good because within that is the suggestion that I could have an affair, that someone could desire me, that I could desire someone, I was a sexual being in her eyes. 6 years later, 7 years of marriage, I've been on this tour for months, I ran out of pants. So I bought some new pants in Lincoln, I think. Lincoln pants. Green ones, you know. Didn't have any other colours. It hides the stains, doesn't it? Of my urine, which is green for the purposes of this. I've got some new pants, 6 years of marriage later, 7 years of marriage. And my wife said, "Oh, you've bought new pants. Did you shit yourself at work?" It doesn't give me any pleasure to get such big laughs off a shit your pants joke. Not when some of the good stuff's gone to nothing. And when there's people that have bought their friends and they'll be saying to them afterwards, "Oh, they said to them before they brought them, they went, oh, he's like a postmodern, he's very clever, he deconstructs the art of performing, and their friends are going, I like the shitted pants bit. Like, dear, what can you do? I got nothing. I drive around, I look after kids. I didn't want to end the first half on a shitted pants bit. You know, give me any. I wanted to end it on a callback in French. But you wouldn't have that, would you? You get the shows you deserve. That's it. That's how the first half ends.